Well, a few decades ago, we all lived with the animals we ate. Today, the animals we live with are pets, and the animals we eat live and die in giant factories thousands of miles away. This leads us to ask, can we bring the animals we eat back home to the farm?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Show with your host, Michael Olson. Now, get ready for an hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Well, hello out there. You are tuned into the 803rd edition of the Food Chain Radio program right here on News Talk Radio. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends over there in Milan who are tuned in as we stream along in the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio with engineer Ricochet on the boards. Hello, Rick.
Good day, Michael.
Folks, it was not all that long ago that we actually lived with the animals we ate. Many can still remember those days. I do. As a young boy growing up on a grandparents' farm near Belfry, Montana, my job was to help feed, nurture, kill, and butcher the animals we ate. In fact, on those working farms, every person and every animal had a job. There were no pets on the farm. Of course, we have all since moved off the farm and into the city. The animals we now live with are pets, to which we often grant full citizenship in the family, with rights to eat dinner at the table, watch TV on the couch, and sleep on the bed. On the other hand, the animals we eat now live and die behind the high walls of distant factories where we cannot see, hear, smell, or touch them. Truth be told, When word leaks out, as it usually does in a purloined video or something, of how our food animals are now treated, we city people shudder at the terror. How can they treat our animals so cruelly, we ask. But truth be told, those concentrated animal feeding operations treat our food animals about as humanely as possible, given the exigencies of raising thousands upon thousands upon thousands of them in tightly packed containers. The reality is simply that it can't get much better for our food animals unless we bring them back home to the farm, which leads us to ask today, can we bring our food animals back home to the farm? Well, here to help us carve up some answers, we have some very interesting people. I'll start with Ryan Wren, who is a custom butcher from Sonoma County, California. Ryan, welcome to the Food Chain.
Good morning. How are you?
Pleasure to have you aboard. What is a custom butcher for those people out there who don't even know what a butcher is?
Well, a custom butcher is basically a couple of things. It is either someone who cuts animals for farmers who bring it to them for sale at the farmer's market, or for individuals who go in together on, a half a steer or half a hog or a whole hog or a lamb, and they want it cut and packed for themselves, and they would purchase that directly from a farmer. So that's kind of what a custom butcher is.
Where did you learn to be a custom butcher?
I learned to be a custom butcher at a place called Willowside Meats up in Sonoma County, or Santa Rosa. They're a state-inspected shop, and so they do not do anything for farmers markets and stuff like that, but they focus and have focused for 45 years, I think, on cutting animals that people raise and then, through a loophole, sell to consumers.
Would that be kind of like 4-H clubs animals and whatnot?
Yes, they do that as well, but That is a portion of the business, but it is very similar. The 4-H and all the fairs, that's one. You know, there's the actual season, they call it fair season up here, where you're, you know, very busy and hard to take other people's animals that they want processed. But mostly it's for, say, you and three of your friends want to buy a steer from the guy down the road. You know he raised it. You like what he does. You think you're going to get a fair price, or you know you'll get a fair price compared to what you're paying in the markets. And so you say, hey, you know, can we get this slaughtered? You purchase it live weight. The ranch butcher comes out. He slaughters it, brings it down to us, and then you come in and we sit down and we go, okay, how big do you want your roast? You know, how many steaks? Do you want steaks? You know, all of that kind of stuff.
There you go. Well, I Googled your name, Ryan Rinn, and lo and behold, up hops a video of you in a butchering contest. You look like you were having a lot of fun.
Yeah, I was.
What was
I
that?
It was the Eat Real Festival. That was, I think, a couple of years ago. Down in Oakland, it was myself and Oscar Yedra and his nephew, Renato, and they're quite talented guys. And basically, it's a contest for breaking a hindquarter steer. And it's it's an interesting contest. I really enjoyed because you're judged on your ability to follow instructions and ability to be creative at the same time, which is really, I think, speaks to being a good butcher, you know.
A good custom butcher.
Yeah, a good custom butcher, exactly, because, you know, I can give you what you want and at the same time be able to help you get more out of whatever it is that you're having us cut, whatever carcass it is.
Well, good enough. And let's go now to Thomas Whitman, my friend from EcoFarm, the EcoFarm guy, past president of the EcoFarm board. EcoFarm is what, Thomas?
Good morning, Michael and Ryan.
Hi.
Well, EcoFarm is a conference. Well, first of all, let me tell you, it's a conference, but the Ecological Farming Association, which is the organization, the nonprofit that puts on the conference, is a 33-year-old organization that has been working on sustainable agriculture. And the EcoFarm Conference is kind of our big event every year. And we take over the whole Asilomar Conference Center grounds.
In January?
January 23rd to 26th.
Always a big January event, the EcoFarm Conference.
Yeah, and now it's January 22nd to 26th because we have an extra day of long events.
And part of that
is the butchering.
This is something totally new for EcoFarm. Having followed the EcoFarm Conference and people for some 30 years, I was truly amazed to hear that they're actually featuring a live course on butchering, because for forever EcoFarm was kind of like sprouts and beans.
Well, we like to do what farmers are doing, and more small farmers are getting into livestock operations. You know, small, you know, having chickens and turkeys and pigs and lamb and sheep. And some have a few steer, you know. Everyone's trying to figure out how to diversify, and meat's a big part of everyone's diet. And meat raised on the farm, like you said earlier, is the best. I mean, when I was a farmer at Molino Creek Farm in Davenport, we raised our own pigs, and they were the best meat ever.
Yeah. So before we entered the show, Ryan, we were engaged in a conversation. We were talking about One-Shot Willie. And One-Shot Willie was a custom butcher, I guess. You know, people would raise a steer. They would call up One-Shot Willie, and Willie would drive out to the farm and slaughter the animal and then butcher it right there on the spot. Whatever happened to One-Shot Willies of the world?
The One-Shot Willies of the world. There just isn't not that many people doing them. I mean, it's, where do you want me to start? Basically, a lot of people moved away from buying animals in bulk. People didn't stop buying freezer beef. You know, I'm sure your parents bought beef for the freezer.
Yep.
I know mine did.
Yep.
They would buy a hindquarter.
Mm-hmm.
People started moving too quick. You know, the move-in of box stores and their butcher compartments made it a lot easier. They don't have to store beef. A little more affluence, I think, is what has contributed to that. You know, the whole move away from, this is prior to the local movement. So they, you know, once he retires, there's no one to take over his place. I know it's a hard job. I've done it. And a lot of people are like, I don't want to work that hard. I mean, that's what all the old timers say. You ask an old timer why there's no custom slaughter guys out there, say no one wants to work that hard, you know.
Old timers say that about just about everything.
That's true. That's true.
Why doesn't anybody take out the garbage? Nobody wants to work anymore.
Do it anymore.
There
exactly.
You go. Pretty much it. So why did we, what happened, I don't know, just a generation or two ago, all of a sudden we moved to the, what do they call them, the concentrated animal feedlot operation. Gee whiz, we have to take a break. But when we come back, I'd like to take a look at those CAFOs and the state of our meat trade today, which I think will help explain why people like Thomas Whitman and EcoFarm and other people are bringing back this whole notion of local butchery and local animals. Folks, this is the Food Chain radio program. Michael Olson here. Today we're seeing if we can bring our meat animals back to the farm where they once lived, where they don't have to be treated so inhumanely as they must be treated in those large factory settings. And you're invited to participate today if you so desire. We're at 831-479-1080. Pick up your phone and join us. We're talking the elite meat.
Get this. You can earn a 5-, 6-, or 7-figure income by farming a small parcel of land in or near the city. You can be old or young, rich or poor, married or single. You can rent, lease, or own. You can farm small fruits on prairie benchlands, houseplants in coastal valleys, flowers on steep wooded hillsides, vegetables in city green belts, ornamentals in neighborhoods of million-dollar homes. There's only one catch. You must compete with other farmers for the consumer dollars. You can compete with others and win the consumer dollars with the help of MetroFarm, the guide to growing for profit in or near the city. MetroFarm is the Ben Franklin Book of the Year Award winner that will guide you step by step through the planning and development of your very own income-generating metropolitan farm. Abraham Lincoln said the greatest fine art of the future will be the making of a comfortable living on a small parcel of land. Get in on the future today. Get a copy of MetroFarm at www.metrofarm.com.
Well, folks, there was a time when we used to live with the animals we ate. But, hey, we all moved into town, and we moved our animals, the ones we ate at least, into concentrated animal feeding operations way out there and somewhere else, somewhere where we can't see or smell or touch or feel them. And yet, when it comes right down to it, when somebody sneaks into those factory farms and takes video of how the animals that we eat are treated, we city people go ballistic and say, you can't treat animals like that. Well, when it gets right down to it, you know, the truth be told, those large factory operations really can't treat animals any other way because, you know, there's the exigencies of having thousands upon thousands of them cramped into these little tight confinement facilities. So that's just going to be the way it is unless we can somehow figure out some way of bringing animals back to the farm. Where we can treat them, perhaps, like they should be treated. Well, that's just the notion that we're playing with today. But how on earth did we come to sending all of our animals to those giant CAFOs, as they're called, Thomas?
I think it just was a matter of the reduction of maybe medium to large family farms. And the fact that taking care of animals as part of the whole realm of farming. I mean, when we were farming, we had a lot of different animals, and they required a lot of work. And the harvest
they did, didn't they? Oh, my goodness, yeah.
And the harvest of those animals, we started by doing all our own harvesting, and it was a kind of a big, long, messy, backbreaking job. And then when we figured out that we could hire out the harvest and send the meat to a meat locker where it could be, you know, safely stored for a long time. I mean, no one has enough freezer space for much meat. And then we just go to the meat locker and get it as we wanted it. It was really convenient. But I think even the meat lockers are probably suffering right now.
I could tell you, I have, you know, on the break I had thought about it for a second. And basically there was a specific event. And without delving into politics, because I don't get involved with that, but basically in the early 70s, Jerry Brown thought that he was doing a favor to all of the small cut-and-wrap shops. And he decided to all of the state-inspected cut-and-wrap shops, he said that they could then become federally inspected.
Ooh.
And the And basically, and I think in his defense, he was thought that he would was doing them a favor because it would allow them to have more business. The only problem was is that the USDA has much stricter guidelines as far as SSOPs and which is a standard operating sanitation procedure and just stricter standards. They're there all the time as far as having someone on your back, and a lot of the state inspected places were not accustomed to that. And so basically what happened is by virtue of the regulations that were passed down through becoming federal, it put a lot, I would say, almost all of the state-inspected cut-and-wrap shops under because they couldn't meet the guidelines, and they finally said, forget it, I'm going to go into construction. I'm going to do something else.
Mm-hmm.
And so by virtue of the lack of shops, lockers like you're talking about, you know, people moved away from it. You know, where are you getting your animal processed? Well, we can't find a place. Well, we're going to take it halfway across town, and then, you know, you got to drive it all over the place to have it happen. And at the end of the day, you're like, well, you know, you start doing the math, the gas, all of that. You're like, it's easier for me just to buy it at a market.
There you go. So, Ryan, we moved our animals to these giant and regulations, government regulations, or
yeah.
We hope to pick up later here because
I don't mean to get
no, it's a great intro, but we moved all our animals to these CAFOs, these confined concentrated animal feeding operations. Now when we see videos taken from these places, we city people all, you know, go into anxiety attacks at the cruelty by which we treat these animals. Is there any other way to treat them when you have the exigencies of having thousands of them in a packed in a container like that?
No, not really. I mean, you got to think about it. It's business. You know what I mean? And mm-hmm. I hate to be rough about it, but it's all about the dollar. And so if you want to make the most money for, because it costs a lot to run a facility like that, you know, then you're going to pack them in. And you got to pack them in and pack them out. You got to give them a low dose of antibiotics so they're going to gain weight fast. You know, you got to and not get sick from being too close together. I mean, it's really, if you want to make like a corporate agribusiness where you're moving the product in and out, then that's the way to do it, you know, because, you know, there's no other way. I mean, you really, it puts us in a bind where we need to be going back to the way things were when our parents bought the hindquarter beef or got together with their friends down the road and said, let's find something to put in a freezer. I mean, that's the only option unless you're comfortable with the uncomfortable animal, you know?
Either that or just eating soybeans and getting over it.
Yeah, exactly. But, I mean, if you look at your teeth and
the rest of your body.
The rest of your body, you know, eating soybeans will only get you so far.
Well,
so.
You know, the interesting thing is I'm coming to see this whole reversion back to, you know, the way things were as kind of a movement of elite meat because it's really becoming elite. You know, you see people like Joel Salatin, Bill Neiman, the EcoFarm people here. They're coming across with things like grass-fed beef, free-range, antibiotic-free, organic. And it actually seems to be taking hold a little bit. A couple of quick stories. I was at Joel Salatin's Polyface Farm in Swope, Virginia. And when I pulled into the parking lot, there were a long line of people waiting to buy chickens. And so I kind of sidled up to one gal and most of these people came all the way from Washington, D.C. I said, ma'am, did you really come from Washington, D.C. all the way just to buy a chicken? And she looked at me with surprise in her face, and she said, well, absolutely not. I came to buy a Salatin chicken.
Huh.
And so there's kind of this really elite thing about food, these meats that were produced the way our grandparents, our parents used to produce them. And it seems like that's why we're headed back that way. But the question is why? Thomas?
Well, I think it's a culture of flavor and quality. I mean, when we were farming, we grew tomatoes in a way that very few people did at the time, dry farming. And that made the best tasting firmest tomato you could imagine. And the meats we grew as well, the turkeys, the chickens, the pigs, the meat was exceptional in quality. And, of course, when you're butchering, you can tell that an animal's really healthy by looking at its organs. So I think it's just a matter that people are using their food dollars as wisely as they can, not buying the cheapest thing they can, but buying the best quality they can, because the best quality food is going to make you healthier.
Well, Ryan, I had an occasion recently to dine at the Ritz-Carlton, and I had a Neiman Ranch ribeye, but there on the menu, they really held this up. Hey, this is not just a ribeye. This is a Neiman Ranch ribeye. Is this are these local meats really becoming that elite?
Well, you got to think about what. There's two parts to it. I mean, people are looking to get a connection to what they eat. You know, they want that, you know, relationship. And, you know, think about how much it takes to raise a steer. I think people lose contact about, you know, it's 18 to 24 months of feeding, caring. You know, that's almost a year. So you're basically, I mean, you know, people drink a fine glass of wine and be like, oh, they swoon over it. But, you know, it is. It's great beef, you know, and there's care, and there is, you know, they're not just slamming it out trying to make a buck. They're paying attention.
Let's pick that up when we come back and talk about what it takes to grow local meat. Let's talk about what it takes to feed and nurture and to kill and to butcher and to package and to sell and on and on and on. Folks, this is the Food Chain. We're talking the elite meat, which is a local meat, and you're invited to participate at 831-479-1080. Do stay tuned. Well, what happens, you know, when we see those videos of how animals are treated at those giant, confined, concentrated animal feeding operations known as CAFOs? We've taken all of our animals that we eat, and we've concentrated them in these giant factories. And you know, those people are in business to make money and not to lose money. So, you know, they're not going to treat animals poorly because they would lose money. The animal dies, you can't butcher it. So they're doing their best, I believe, to treat animals as humanely as possible. But even then, we see the videos and we cringe in horror at how our animals are treated. Well, I'm here to say I don't think it can be any better in those factory-like settings for the animals. The only way we can make it better for the animals is to bring them home to the farm. Can we do that? That's the question we have on the table today with custom butcher Ryan Wren from Sonoma County and also Thomas Whitman, he of EcoFarm Conference and Ecological Farming Association. And you, 831-479-1080 is the phone number. So we see these videos. What is our reaction, Thomas?
Well, it's pretty horrifying. But when you make the association of those videos and the meat that's on your table, you realize you're not getting really what is good. I mean, you can just imagine how much stress those animals are under. And when animals are stressed, they're not healthy. They pump adrenaline in their systems all the time. I mean, the object of a humane harvest of an animal is, and life of an animal, is to make sure there's no stress in the animal's life. And I think the harvest part is a real critical part. Not saying that animals in a CAFO know what's going on. But,
I think they do.
But they know they're all bunched together and something's not right.
Something's not right. Something is not fun. Ryan, have you ever seen that?
What, where animals all bunched together
in
a slaughterhouse?
Like mm-hmm.
Yeah, you know, I've seen that. They know what's coming down. I think animals, I mean, all the steers that I've been around that have done custom slaughters out, they all know what's coming down. You know, for me, it's the life up until the slaughter that I worry about. You know, that's where your biggest difference is. You know, when you're looking at these large, you know, feedlots and things like that, That's where, you know, you start getting into problems because you're trying to raise an animal under a condition that's not going to be great. And so you're going to have to take measures in order to compensate for the situation which you've created in the first place by virtue of trying to do a lot in one place.
Right.
And that's what you run into with from chicken farms to, you know, to feedlots for beef or a factory.
To salmon, to turtles, to... Yeah. I don't think they figured out turkeys yet, though. To the extent that they can keep them in a tiny cage, you have to let them run around in a field, I think.
No, turkeys, you look at these Butterballs or Rosa brand, you know, all those are raised in they're just like chickens, basically.
Yeah.
You know, you want to get like a heritage breed diesel chicken. Turkey.
Yep.
I heard a little beep or whatever. You.
That was the FDA listening in.
Oh, okay. Sorry.
Well, let me ask you this. Let's talk a little bit about bringing these animals home to the farm. And what is it like to raise a steer?
I could speak about that if the other guy doesn't want to.
Sure, go ahead, Ryan.
Go ahead.
Okay, so I mean it's 18 to 24 months. You gotta get you have to, number one, have space for it, which is always tricky these days, the cost of land and all. then you run it on grass, and some people they want to grain it out at the end, so they'll fatten it up towards the last, you know, 6 to 10 weeks of its life. Other people want to grass grain it, you know, or they want to confine it a little bit so it's not running around on the hill. And when I say confine, I don't mean like sticking a lot where it can't walk around and it's walking its own feces, but you want to fatten it up like you would if I was going to eat you. You know, I want you to hold still and don't exercise very much because I want you to be fat when I...
Fat and tender, right?
Uh-huh. Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
Wow. That's getting pretty personal, right?
Yeah, I guess.
Yeah,
so.
Well, you know, I try and figure out a good way to explain that to people, and I always revert back to the exercise.
Well, okay, then let's talk about the ultimate tough way of describing things. What is the politically correct way of describing the killing of an animal that you're going to eat?
Oh, the politically correct way. Well, these days people say harvest. And that, I think it's a little too PC for me, but that is the politically correct way to say it.
We used to call it slaughter.
Yeah, me too. But I guess slaughter brings up, you know, I don't know, images from human rights violations. I'm not really sure.
It's back to those videos again.
It's back. Yeah, yeah, I guess
exactly.
So. Maybe that's it. Maybe that's where the badness in that word came. How does one humanely harvest an animal?
Well, it depends. If you're going to do, like, a steer, if you're going to go and do a ranch kill, you'll go out there and you'll shoot it with a .22, and then that knocks it, basically puts it unconscious. Then you hit the artery right in the neck. It bleeds out. You can save the blood if you want or not. Use it for fertilizer. Everybody's got their own thing they want to do. And then it dies. It's pretty much it. Once mm-hmm. the bullet gets into that brain, it's dead.
That's just the way we used to do it when I was a kid on the farm. Thomas, you talked about the fear of animals and how it's important not to let the animal be frightened before you harvest it.
Oh, I really feel strongly about that in terms of the quality of the meat. And we always were worried about adrenaline getting into the meat. So when we were harvesting our pigs, for example, and sometimes we let our pigs get too big, and they were a little bit harder to deal with. And so we would do the usual thing with a .22, give it a shot in the head, and then we'd run into the pen and cut the artery. And sometimes that pig, its head would be so big that the thing would come back awake again, and we'd be wrestling with this thing in the pen. We didn't want that to happen.
Yeah. You can tell in the meat when it's stressed. Especially with hogs, you'll get like it's like a blood spotting in the hams. And it looks like, you know, not like big blood spots, but they're just little flecks. And you go, okay, well, this was a stress. You know, you want to be calm and smooth mm-hmm. and like have a nice thought in your head when you go in there. I mean, I don't really know how else to put it, and just you be swift and nice about it.
You know, in thinking about this, you could always, having been raised in Montana, I was a hunter, and hunted for many years before I came out to California. But one of the things you learned is that the ultimate kill or harvest was to take an animal down without it knowing. Because if it was on the run, if it knew you were shooting at it, you could taste it in the meat every time. So then I guess the idea is to be as sweet and gentle as possible. And I don't think you can do that in a CAFO, but perhaps you can on the farm.
Well, you can only do it on the farm if you have enough experience to know what you're doing.
There you go.
An inexperienced slaughter person gets in trouble.
It's messy. You know,
okay.
It's hard. It's a hard one. Go ahead.
Quick break. We're going to come back. We're going to talk about the butchering of the animal that you just harvested. Folks, this is the Food Chain Radio Program. 831-479-1980. If you have any questions about animals, go ahead and fire away. We've got the experts here. Ryan Wren, Custom Butcher. Thomas Whitman, Mr. Eco Farm. Do stay tuned. Right back.
Great shot, Bob. I think you're on.
I just followed your lead.
Hey, by the way, did you break ground on your new building?
No way. I'm holding off until I see what the future holds.
So you're seeing a fortune teller?
You know what I mean. Things look a little uncertain.
The only thing certain in business is if you're not growing, you're losing. And we just opened our fifth facility last week. If you're following my lead, you'll call General Steel. Their pre-engineered steel buildings could save you as much as half the cost compared to conventional buildings. And they're up in nearly half the time, and back with a 50-year structural warranty.
Yeah, but steel buildings...
Hey, you've seen my building. Does it look like steel?
No, it looks great.
Ask about rebates that could save you up to $20,000. Look, you can stop paying rent and own a building that suits your business better and probably saves you money by operating more efficiently. In times like these, don't stop spending. Just spend wisely.
Call 800-965-1290. 800-965-1290, 800-965-1290.
Get this. You can earn a 5-, 6-, or 7-figure income by farming a small parcel of land in or near the city. You can be old or young, rich or poor, married or single. You can rent, lease, or own. You can farm small fruits on prairie bench lands, houseplants in coastal valleys, flowers on steep wooded hillsides, vegetables in city green belts, ornamentals in neighborhoods of million-dollar homes. There's only one catch. You must compete with other farmers for the consumer dollars. You can compete with others and win the consumer dollars with the help of MetroFarm, the guide to growing for profit in or near the city. MetroFarm is the Ben Franklin Book of the Year Award winner that will guide you step by step through the planning and development of your very own income-generating metropolitan farm. Abraham Lincoln said the greatest fine art of the future will be the making of a comfortable living on a small parcel of land. Get in on the future today. Get a copy of MetroFarm at www.metrofarm.com.
Dave, what are you doing?
Just sending a gift to Dave 2037.
Who?
Me in the future. I save a little money from every paycheck as a gift to Dave 2037, so he can spend it on things like anti-gravity boots or a hologram Doberman. Something cool like that. I think Dave 2037 deserves it. He worked hard. What are you getting Steve 2037?
I guess I was thinking Steve 2037 would just fend for himself.
Well, all right, but don't expect to be borrowing my anti-gravity boots.
You want to have money in your future? You got to start saving now. Putting some money from every paycheck into a savings account or contributing to your 401k can make a big difference later. Put away a few bucks, feel like $1 million. For free ideas and easy ways to save, go to feedthepig.org. That's
feedthepig.org. Hey, let's just hope Steve 2037 doesn't get his hands on a cold time machine, because he is going to come back here and knock some sense into you.
This message brought to you by the American Institute of Certified Public Accountants and the Ad Council.
Hey, well, Thomas here has a great story about scratch and sniff and importance of a good custom butcher for a small farmer.
Well, this was back in our early days of farming with animals, and we had these two pigs that we got, and we fed them our ag scraps. We actually went around town and got scraps from all the organic food stores and grew them and grew them and grew them. And we
kept growing.
Never quite got to the harvest part until they were about 500 or 600 pounds. And then we had a big job. And as an inexperienced, it was our first big harvest. That's how that story happened that I said before, where the animal wasn't killed outright. And so The reason I'm mentioning this is because I think it's really important for a small farmer or a farmer that's inexperienced to have a professional come on the farm to do the harvest. And like One Shot Willie, when he came, he would take care of the job, and he had this truck that was like a tow truck where he could hoist the animal up and clean the animal out and then put it right in a bed of ice on the back of his truck. So, Ryan, I was wondering if you, part of your service is like a professional slaughter.
Well, we're working on...
Harvester.
I'm a professional harvester. Sounds like a farm equipment. So right now, my partner and I are trying to open a custom cut and wrap federal facility up in Sonoma County. And that will be part of the service. Right now, we're in the process of doing that. So, yes, I have done it. Right now, I don't have a rig. And that's what I tell people when they ask me, oh, will you come in? Slaughter my animal, I'd be like, I'd love to.
Why is
really
it important
would.
To have a rig?
Oh, for the exact reasons. You need to have a setup. You need to have a hoist. You need to have a truck that you can get it to the cut and wrap shop. And you need to, it just, you have to have the proper equipment.
You can't do it with a Volkswagen.
No, I mean, you can, for sure. But then you're going to have a stress deal. You're going to have to worry about, you know, whether it's cooling properly, you have to worry about they're going to split it right. Otherwise, mm-hmm. it could come out crooked. And when it, you know, dries a bit, it cools, it hit, the rigor mortis sets in, it'll twist, and then you'll lose your yield, basically.
And that's what Thomas was talking about, the importance of a good custom butcher so you don't lose the yield. When you're working with small amounts of a crop, like custom animals, you can't afford to lose any of them, so you got to get everything, right?
Well, and that it's
right.
clean. I mean, with a rig, everything is clean. You're not dragging the animal around on the ground with your tractor.
Oh, yeah.
So, Ryan, when we used to harvest deer, we used to hang them for a few days. Do you do that with beef?
Depends. So, I have guidelines that I go by, and it worked for me. So if you raise sheep, unless you otherwise specify, a lamb will hang a week, and that's going to be your best product. It's going to be dry enough where, you know, when you go to sear the chops or, you know, put a nice little bit of color on the leg, it's going to be you get a nice caramelization. Steers, if it has a lot of cover, then cover means fat, you know, a good amount of fat in it, mm-hmm. you can hang it for 2.5-3 weeks if you really are into the aged beef flavor. You know, some people like that, some people don't.
What's the difference?
What's the difference in flavor?
Yes.
For me, I think that an aged beef, if it has the fat cover, it has a nice kind of nutty flavor to it. Then basically the enzymes in the meat start to break it down a little bit. It's a little bit more tender. I really like it. Some people don't. Some people say it tastes a little bit too much like a nickel. If it doesn't have the fat cover and you try and age it, you're just going to lose your yield. You're going to get, you know, a little bit of mold on it, which isn't a bad thing, but you're going to have to cut that off. And, you know, it's going to dry up. You're going to lose a lot of your moisture content. And that's, you know, it's money, basically.
So
like I said,
probably grass-fed beef would not be something that you want to age.
Not necessarily. You can age grass-fed beef if it has the fat content. So, for example, I'm going to raise a grass-fed steer. What I'll do is I'll grass lot it at the end. So I'll put it in a smaller area. And I'll put the feed. I'll let the grass go to seed in that area.
Mm-hmm.
So I'll let it grow up. So they're getting a little bit more fats from the grain heads.
Oh.
And so then there's going to be more fat in the beef, and then it's going to have a little more fat. So you can be like, oh, I'll let it hang for a week, maybe a week and a half.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it's going to dry up a little bit. It's not going to be really wet, but so, I'm not going to lose too much money.
So this really is important to have a custom kind of concept, because if you treat everything the same, you're going to get a real broad mediocrity, I guess.
Yeah, which everybody has... different taste, you know. Right. Everybody's got different taste.
Definitely. Which is really what we get when we go to the meats that come from these factories, is that we get mediocrity because it's impossible to do anything else, I would suspect. So, packaging. Well, first of all, cutting up the beef. Tell us quickly about that.
Well, I mean, how do you want me to tell you how to break a steer?
Yeah, how do you break
okay.
it?
Okay.
You have a whole animal hanging there. What the heck do you do with it?
So usually it'll be divided into quarters. So because a whole steer is quite long, and so it'll be on hooks on a rail in quarters. So it'll be front quarter, hind quarter. That's half a steer, for example. So, you know, I could give you a quick rundown. So you go up between the fifth and the sixth rib. You split it. You pull off the cross rib. Then you pull off the brisket, break off the shank, cut that if the ossobuco if you want, the cross rib.
Wait a
you
minute. We're just
that.
About out of time, but
yeah, I know. What do you want me to?
When we come back, I have the really big question for both of you, which was, can local meat survive the new federal food safety regulations coming down from Michael Taylor? But before we go, I have to ask you, Ryan Rinn, what's your favorite cut of meat?
Oh, my favorite cut of meat. Yeah. Well, it changes. But right now, it's kind of what I feel like. But right now, I really like the bistro filet, which is off the cross rib.
Mm-hmm.
Bistro filet is one name. It would be a chuck tender.
Hold on, right back, folks. Do stay tuned. Well, I just have to know before we go, what is a bistro filet, Ryan Rowe?
It's basically a small muscle group that lays on top of the cross rib. And most markets will wind up grinding it if you go to your butcher, but it's literally lays on, looks like a, the way I was taught was it looks like a fish that lays on top of the cross rib.
Huh.
And I would say right now, and next week it'll be different, and the week after that I'll probably have a different favorite piece.
How do you cook it?
I like to sear it right now, cut it in half, sear it on all sides, medium rare, and then slice it in little medallions. It's about, I would say, I don't know, it's almost the same size as a whole pork tenderloin, maybe a touch smaller.
Uh-huh.
That's kind of if you're in, you know, looking for it. So you cut it in little medallions and, try not to eat it all at once.
Bistro filet. So let me ask you this. Michael Taylor, Monsanto's Michael Taylor, who is now in charge of the food safety for the United States of America Food and Drug Administration, just came out with a whole set of new rules and regulations on food safety. And I suspect the USDA will be doing the same thing, too. So the government's coming after everybody to make certain our food is safe. Can local meat survive the federal government's regulations? I mean, you talked about Jerry Brown.
Yeah, I know. I'm going to get in trouble. I'll be dealing with the USDA. You said that on the radio.
Well, we already know they have us tapped. So,
I don't want to say it's a fight, but they're basically looking to keep the public safe, and I understand that. And they're dealing with the large agribusiness, and so it's their job to monitor that. However, if you put that filter to a local level, it really makes it difficult.
Isn't that not part of what's going on here, that the large industrial people do not want competition from people like you? And so this is a great way of taking care of people like you?
Definitely. It is, for sure. But, people will find a way. There will always be a way. I have tremendous faith in people to find a way to get around it. There's always a way around.
Okay, Thomas Whitman, how are we going to get around it?
Well, one way to get around it is to come to the butchery skills workshop at EcoFarm.
Who's teaching it?
Well, Ryan, who we're talking to, is one of the butchers that's going to teach it. Also, Lauren Azaki from Flea Street Cafe, Cool Eats in Menlo Park, incredible place to eat. But just for in the last couple of minutes, if you're interested in this butchering on a small farm or raising animals for anything, you won't find a workshop like this anywhere. It's all day long, 9 to 5. Get basic skills.
And so people can learn about this by going to ecofarm.org?
Eco-farm.org.
Eco-farm.org. So, Ryan Rinn, you're going to teach this class on butchering to people who probably have never cut up a piece of meat before. Are you going to teach them how to make a bistro steak, and then are you going to barbecue it and feed it to them?
Well, unfortunately, we're not doing any steers, but I think... There will be plenty of food. I think the Cool Eats place is going to be providing the food, and we'll go into that. But I think it's really important, even if you don't plan ever on cutting your own steer as a farmer or not, to understand the, how it comes apart. And a lot of what we'll be covering in the class is how to maximize your yield as a farmer.
Hey, thank you very much. Ryan Rinn, Custom Butcher, Sonoma County, Thomas Whitman, Eco Farm, Ecological Farming Association. Thank you all for tuning in. Can we bring our animals we eat home to the farm? What do you think? Thank you for tuning in.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Show with Michael Olson. If your friends missed the show today, tell them to log on to the radio page at www.metrofarm.com for a listen. Now go out and find some food with a farmer's face on it and live.